Coming up today, Dutch police recruit a rat detective to sniff out crime. Plus, Japan aims to beam solar energy down from orbit, how bizarre, and a pair of scientists want to turn smartphones into earthquake detectors. Plus, do you recognise this voice?
The idea that we know that the universe is 13.798 plus or minus 0.035 billion years old. How did we do that?
That's the voice of Professor Brian Cox, who'll join us for the entire second half of today's show. All that and more is coming up. This is the Wired.co.uk podcast, your weekly guide to the important and the interesting, from science and tech to police, rodents, and of course, Brian Cox. I'm your host, Nate Langson. I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk.
I'm Olivia underscore Solon.
And I'm Leah Clark.
And yes, we're going to be joined in a little bit by Prof. Brian Cox, who I met up with yesterday to have a chat about all things Higgs, all things science, all things one-way manned missions to Jupiter's moons, and various other things. So we're going to do half the show is news, and then half the show is going to be with Brian. So don't miss that. Let's get on with the news. Now, the first bit of news we're going to do this week is about the Dutch police force recruiting rat detectives for £8 a pop to sniff out crime. The writer of this story was Nicholas, who is here. Hi, Nicholas.
Hello.
Back by popular demand.
Of course, yes. Of course. Now, this this woman is called Monique Hammerslag. I think that's how you pronounce her name. I do apologise if I got that wrong. And she's recruited Derek, Thompson & Thompson, Magnum and Poirot. Now, the thing about these recruits is that they're rats.
And they're brilliantly named rats.
They are. Fantastically named rats. Basically, the idea is that you get these rats and you train them to sniff out certain odours. So things like gunpowder, drugs, etc. And then if you have someone who you suspect has shot someone and you're trying to find traces of gunpowder on them, then you can set a rat on them. For instance, Detective Derek, who I hear is very good and only £8. And then the rat will sort of squeak or make some sort of signal if it believes that that particular individual has fired a gun or taken some pretty hardcore drugs.
How this isn't a television series aimed at teenagers absolutely baffles me, but it's a brilliant idea. But my question is, why not use dogs? Because these are, to be fair, tried and tested, four-legged, quadrupedic. Is that a word? Quadrupedic?
It is now.
It is now. Members of the police forces worldwide.
So the key is cost. So to train a rat, such as Detective Derek, it is just £8. Or rather, it costs £8 to buy him. And then it really doesn't cost that much to then train a rat, because all you need is a cage and a couple of tea strainers to put a scent in. And you put one scent in one tea strainer, and then you sort of leave the rat in the cage. And when the rat finds the gunpowder, you treat the rat with either a little click, which they apparently quite like, or a treat, presumably cheese.
Liv, I'm pretty sure rats are actually quite shy, aren't they? They tend to run away from things.
Yeah, but it's not like they're going to be put onto leads and used as attack rats in the same way that the dogs are used. This is a very specific smell-related skill that they need to use. They can be shy and wily.
Exactly, and they are shy. And they are very wily. But the way they combat this shyness is, according to Hammerslag, they get the smell and they present it to the rat. Whereas with a dog, you would sort of say, you would send the dog off to try and locate some sort of smell. Whereas with the rat, it's not a natural predator, so it gets frightened easily. And so they say, here's a smell and see if you can find it.
Critical question. Do they get a police uniform?
They don't. Unlike, however, the monkeys in Thailand, there's one monkey called Santusuk in Thailand. Again, I hope I pronounced his name correctly.
I'm sure he won't give a damn if you didn't.
He's 5 years old. He's a macaque monkey, and he joined the police in Thailand to improve community relations. But rather adorably, he has a bespoke uniform with a yellow badge on the back proclaiming monkey police, which I think is wonderful. His other jobs entail sort of checkpoint control, which is hilarious to me, and picking up coconuts for residents.
Fantastic.
There's nothing worse than dropping your coconuts.
There is absolutely nothing wrong when you Drop your coconuts, yes. Yeah. Shrewdly observed there, Nicholas. Well, your story, which is a fascinating read, is on the website. And I'm sure if you search for Dutch police recruit rat detectives on Wide.co.uk, we only have one story to match up. Although, to be honest, Liat, you've written some pretty mad stuff about animals over the last few years. So that might actually not be the case.
Rats are usually having their minds read or some such.
Or appendages being removed. Liat, smartphone chips sense earthquakes, could speed up aid response. Talk about a provocative and fascinating headline.
I try.
Well, you succeed. A pair of scientists think they might be able to turn smartphones into earthquake detectors. This is brilliant.
Yeah, it's a great idea. I think they've been working on it for a couple of years. They want to prove that, yes, we can do this, guys, because obviously smartphones are everywhere. And the most important thing when an earthquake hits, the thing that is most likely to result in more injuries and fatalities is the strength of the earthquake and the speed of response times. Now, if you could measure the earthquake at its epicenter, where the tremors are strongest, then you could send people to the appropriate areas quicker. You wouldn't waste lots of time faffing around. So they're hoping they can use a chip that is already in everyone's smartphones, and you can just download an app and make use of it. So basically, this pair of seismologists from the National Institute of Geophysics and Volcanology, a wonderful field in Italy, they tested how accurate readings from the microelectromechanical systems accelerometer in your phone, what a mouthful, how good they would be at measuring this. So this is in most smartphones. It measures movement across three axes, and it's the thing that tells your phone which way up it is, so your screen is always conveniently the right way around. But this sounds like an infinitely better use for it.
Well, it's certainly a more potentially life-saving use.
Yes, absolutely.
I would say.
Yeah, well, yeah, not bad, you know. No need to. Sorry.
Yeah.
Traveling. So they use the chip that is in iPhone 4 and 5, stuck it on a vibrating table, which is the technical term for the table they shake to measure Richter scales, and used an actual seismometer alongside it to see how accurate the chip's measurements would be. They found that it was spot on for anything of 6 and above on the Richter scale, which is basically anything serious. Anything below that is just kind of minor internal damage. So we're talking about the kind of scale that would rock buildings. So the team behind it, they're not too bothered about its sensitivity, because obviously these are the most serious tremors that it will pick up. And also their thought process is, we need to nail this now, create some applications for it, and the technology will advance and chips will become more sensitive.
And I suppose the other factor of this is that if the phone has GPS, then if this data is being sent to a survey center, they're also going to know not only the initial measurements from the phone, but also exactly where that happens. And en masse, when you're using lots and lots of different devices, they all start reporting the same data, the margin for error there is reduced.
Absolutely, yeah, because
I'm guessing.
The measurements they have now, it's not always obviously from the centre, because they are in permanent spots, whereas in a city centre, that in all likelihood you will have a large number of people with this in their phone tinkering away in the background.
It reminds me of the pothole detecting app. I think it was the city of Boston that developed it, but it was an app that you could just leave on in the background as you drove around the city. And if you drove over a pothole, and for some reason it could distinguish between a pothole and a sleeping policeman, for example, it would then log that data and send it.
Just for some of our international listeners, that's what we call these speed bumps in the road. We don't regularly drive over law enforcement officers or rats.
Yes, I forget. Crazy English ways. British. Yes, so it can detect, the difference between a pothole and another sort of different thing that's meant to be there, and then log that information and send it to a central database so the authorities can then know where they need to go and repave the road.
That is such a great idea.
Oh yeah, another great idea. Perhaps less emergency
less
focused,
pertinent,
less pertinent. But
that's what they did in a study beforehand, which was they had to figure out if it could tell the difference between different types of movement, like running and running, walking and earthquake.
But this is the thing. So I mean, as a slight side note, one of the things that Apple's M7 chip does, which is in the new iPhone 5S, is it can detect the difference in whether you're walking, whether you're in a car, and you can apply that sort of technical knowledge to things like Google Maps or something, where it will give you walking directions if it tells that you're on foot, and driving directions if it tells you're in a car. Because although you're moving and it can tell you're moving, obviously the physical movement of the phone is different sitting in a car that's moving quite smoothly, or then sort of slightly bouncing up and down because it can tell that you're on foot.
And so, that's something it just automatically does.
I think that's something that's going to be fascinating to see over the next few years, actually, is how these sensors and chips, designed perhaps for one function but can be adopted for others, en masse as part of a network of devices, can be used to detect other things as significant as earthquakes. Fantastic. Liv, Japan is aiming to beam solar energy down from orbit.
Yes, it
is. Because why not?
Because why the hell not? Yeah, well, since the nuclear meltdown at Fukushima, Japan's been considering alternative energy sources, they've actually shut down quite a few of their nuclear power stations since then. So it's thinking about solar power, but it's not thinking about just slapping on some solar panels onto houses. It's actually talking about getting closer to the source of that solar power, i.e. the sun. And this is something that the Japanese space agency, JAXA, is doing. It's developing this concept called Space Solar Power System.
SPS, for short.
Yes. Snappy. Oh, it's tough when I've already got a bit of a speech impediment to say that many S's.
No, you haven't.
I really don't. I don't know where this comes from.
But it would consist of placing an array of mirrors into orbit to collect solar energy and then transmit that down to a power plant on the ground, either via microwaves or laser beams.
And by when? Exactly?
By 2030.
Oh, okay.
Which I think is amazing. Yeah. The idea isn't actually new, though. A similar concept was designed in 1968 by an American, but NASA deemed it to be too expensive. However, technology has improved and it's cheaper to get things into orbit now. And the main kind of decision they need to make, the lead researcher Rasayuki Fukumuro needs to make, is whether to use microwaves or laser beams to send the energy back down or to combine them.
So I guess that's what they're testing now.
So they're doing, they're doing some ground-based experiments to test what the most efficient way is to transmit energy. But the reason they're doing this, which I think is quite interesting, is that by going outside the Earth's atmosphere, they can eliminate all the kind of interruptions that you normally have with solar power. So they can guarantee a continuous supply of sunlight with no kind of limitations from whether weather, the seasons or the time of day. They can kind of position it constantly on the sunny side of the Earth. I think this is something like a fixed orbit. I'm not quite sure exactly how it works, but they can fix it at a point so it's always facing the sun. And then they can condense this, focus it down onto a power plant on Earth, and that can be turned into energy that they can use.
I think that was the part that gave way to a few paranoid conspiracy theorists on Twitter. I don't know if you saw this.
What about having a laser beam in space that can destroy cities?
Yes.
That's not a new concern. That's been around for quite a while.
Yes, but that they're publicly working on it.
Yeah, apparently it is a massive challenge focusing, the microwaves specifically, trying to get microwaves to focus to an area. I think it would be a 3-kilometre array on the ground. Trying to get microwaves to focus on that from such a far distance is a mega challenge, but it's one that they're, jumping into with relish. But the other interesting thing that's worth mentioning about this system would be that the carbon dioxide, which is generated from creating the power, would actually be emitted in space. And so the emissions would be reduced from on Earth.
Last little quick one I wanted to mention because it broke shortly before we start recording the show. Apparently Valve, who makes the Half-Life series of games, amongst other things, Steam, has just registered, within the last couple of weeks, Half-Life 3 as a trademark, which I'm very excited about because it's next year will be the 10th anniversary of Half-Life 2. Yeah. And one of the longest standing rumours is that Valve is in the works on Half-Life 3, which is very exciting.
This is one of the most hotly anticipated games of ever, really, isn't it?
In its ilk, it is. In its genre, yeah. I mean, Half-Life 2, which came out, I think, in 2004, was... I mean, it is probably one of the best, if not the best, first-person shooter of all time. And a lot of people will say it's arguably one of the best games of all time.
Yeah.
So to know that possibly a new one could be coming out...
Your face says it all.
It's very exciting. So we've got a story on the site with some detail, a bit of speculation, a bit of rumour, a bit of background. If you search for Half-Life 3 on Wider.co.uk, you will find that. Now, we are going to transition into a quick break. When we come back, no more me. Well, actually, me. But no more Liat, no more Liv. But quite a lot more of Professor Brian Cox. It's that time again, audible.co.uk time, which is still offering you, the listener of the Wired.co.uk podcast, a free audiobook from about a catalogue of 80,000 titles, or even from a catalogue of about 80,000 titles. A 1 month free trial, as ever, costs no pounds, no pence, and you get to download a book of your choice, and it will cost you nothing, even if you cancel that account. So if you head to audible.co.uk/wired, sign up, pick a book, download it for free on us. You'll be supporting our show, as we say every week, and you get a free book as a thank you. So there's very little not to like if you head over now to audible.co.uk/wired. Joining me now, I'm very excited to welcome him to our programme. It is Professor Brian Cox. Brian, welcome.
Hello.
So we're sitting up on the 34th floor of the BT Tower here in central London for your talk, which I understand is the first of the BT Tower talks from BT's Ingenious programme, and focuses on how even the smallest moments of wonder change how we think.
Well, I'm going to talk about mainly the Large Hadron Collider, which is a very big piece of wonderful engineering, but does a very small and subtle experiments which have completely changed our view of the way the universe works. So I think that the, in particular, we talk about the discovery of the Higgs boson, vast collaboration, 88 countries from around the world, testing the theory that's over 50 years old. We invented the World Wide Web in order to do those kind of experiments, so it's a tremendous generator of knowledge and ideas and technologies. But I want to talk about what we actually discovered and why it's one of the most significant discoveries of all time. It's not just another particle. It's always presented as that quite often, actually. It's, oh, the particle physicists have found a new thing at CERN. It is a new thing, but it's a completely new thing. It's a new kind of particle that does fundamental things in the universe.
Now, I was actually going to ask you specifically about the Higgs a little later on, so I'm glad you mentioned it already, because it seemed that at one point it was the hottest topic in science. It was all over the newspapers. And now, at least as far as the media is concerned, it seems to be quite quiet. So did it change physics?
Yes, it showed that we understand physics for the first point. When you look at what went into the prediction, which was made in the 1960s, you've got not only the two foundations, the pillars of 20th century physics, which is quantum mechanics and relativity, built into the prediction. You've got ideas of symmetry, beautiful abstract mathematical ideas of symmetry, ideas of breaking symmetries, which is really one of the ways that complexity emerges in the universe. So it's this story of ideas, all, I would say, pretty much, of the 20th century techniques in theoretical physics go into a prediction which 50 years after it's made it turns out to be true. So it's a remarkable thing. It may have gone quiet in the media, but that's a complete irrelevance from a scientific perspective.
What about the Large Hadron Collider? I mean, what's that up to at the moment, sort of post-Higgs, if you like?
Well, it's been upgraded and down for routine maintenance, which takes a while. The thing about the LHC is that it takes around 3 months to warm up. Runs at minus 271 degrees Celsius. It takes a long time to warm up, a long time to cool down again. So you do all your maintenance in one block. So it's been upgraded. It'll run at higher energy when it comes back on. And as you say, although we discovered a new particle, which is often described as Higgs-like, what kind of Higgs it is not known. So really, it's essentially like saying we've discovered a new planet. And you go, oh, good. Right. The next thing to do is go to the planet and find out what's on the planet and how the planet works and is there life on the planet, all sorts of questions. But it's the same with the Higgs. So we've discovered a thing which looks, roughly speaking, like the simplest Higgs that you can think of. But there are theories where you have five Higgs particles, and those theories actually also contain answers to questions such as what is dark matter? So this stuff that's out there in the universe that we know is there, but we don't know what it's made of, what it is, right? So there's all sorts of stuff. So basically the LHC is just starting its job. It's only taken 1% of the data it's designed to take over its lifetime. The other 99% is first of all, pinning down precisely what this new thing is, what kind of Higgs is it? And secondly, then, where do we go next? There are big questions that are raised by this discovery. One of the great things about the discovery, actually, is it focuses people's minds. It was 1 year ago or 2 years ago, it was possible for lots of people to have lots of ideas about the way the universe works. Now we've been focused again that this is how the universe works in this particular level. Where do we go next?
So you mentioned new worlds and new planets, and one of the things that we've talked about a few times on the podcast and on Wired is manned missions to moons and planets, and recently one-way trip manned missions. Recently there was a DIY mission, I think, to Jupiter's moon Europa, and obviously there's big stories about one-way manned trips to Mars. So when you hear stories about that and these sorts of ventures, like, what do you think of them? I mean, are they viable applications of science, or are they kind of just dreams?
Well, they're viable in the sense it's easier to do a one-way trip than it is to do a return. So from an engineering sense, it's significantly easier to just get to Mars than it is to come back. And that's the, you know, so many people have proposed that there are people who would do it. And you know, that throughout history, there have been people who did that. Essentially, you know, 400 years ago, going to Australia or America was a one-way trip. Very few people would have come back. Maybe 500 years ago to America, you know. But so the idea that people explore for good and don't just do temporary exploration missions is an old one. So you know, in principle, I don't see anything wrong with it, and it is, as I say, significantly easier. The problem with going to a planet and then coming back again is you've got to take all the fuel with you to get back. It's a much more complicated mission. Takes a lot longer, in a sense, in terms of space flight. So the fact that you could conceive, if you can get people who'll do it, to just go into Martian orbit and stay there, or even land on the surface and stay there, I think is a... Well, they'd have to land on the surface, wouldn't they? I don't think they'd stay in orbit forever. It'd be quite boring, wouldn't it? So, you know, I think that's it's viable, whether you know, whether people will allow it to happen. I suppose you can't stop the private sector if they want to do it, you know.
That's what makes it so fascinating.
Tick the health and safety form and off you go.
I need to ask you quickly about the moon, because a lot of the topics that we talk about when we think about...
It's a big piece of rock in orbit around the Earth.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it kind of feels like the moon's done now. Like, it's a bit boring. No one's going back there. It seems like it's given us the science that we wanted from it. And now we're thinking, well, we can get to Mars, so let's do Mars now. I mean, has the moon got anything left to offer us?
Well, actually, there was a reanalysis of some of the Apollo samples this the week, actually, which suggested that the moon might be younger than had first been thought. The more accurate dating techniques were applied to the rocks. So there's still new science coming out of the moon. But you're right, in a sense, the moon is interesting because it was the template for our idea of what a moon is. And really, until you get to Pioneer and then Voyager, we get spacecraft that go out to see the moons of the gas giants, of Jupiter and Saturn in particular. It was, I think most people thought the moons would be not particularly interesting. Of course, it turned out to be absolutely the opposite. Europa, as you mentioned earlier, is one of the prime candidates for life in the solar system, this circumlunar ocean with more water than all the oceans of the Earth combined. But Io around Jupiter, the most volcanically active body in the solar system. Even Triton around Neptune, which is the furthest outpost of our physical exploration, is a place with an active surface, even though it's in deep freeze. So I think that one of the great surprises of the space exploration over the last 40 years has been the diversity of moons. And interestingly, when you look at solar systems, I'm about to go and make a program based on the Drake equation, which is the way of thinking about whether how many intelligent civilizations you may expect in the Milky Way. And this has changed a lot over the last few years in some ways, because we're discovering planetary systems around virtually every star we look at. You know, if you ask an astrophysicist now, they would say, well, we think that solar systems are more common than not out there in the universe and the Milky Way. But you tend to talk of habitable zones around stars as the place where you can put a planet where you can have liquid water on its surface, and that's where you'd find life. But in the last few decades, we've found that you can have life on moons in icy reaches of solar systems, because they can be heated up by these tidal forces, which is to do with their orbits. They don't really need the star to support oceans, which could support life. So I think that's one of the most exciting things we've discovered.
I think that's what I find quite fascinating about the science going on with Lake Vostok, that they've sort of see all this bacteria and life and things sort of sealed away deep under this ice that was just wholly unknown, I think, to science when it was first discovered.
Yeah, you've got these sealed ecosystems, as you say. There are also some pockets of water that are found in, for example, South African gold mines that have been untouched for hundreds of thousands of years. By the atmosphere. There's been no mixing into those little pockets of water, like Lake Vostok, probably. But you see life there that survived all this time with no discernible energy source. I mean, there are energy sources there for it. I think it's radioactivity primarily in the gold mines, actually. that powers the life runs very slowly. So you're right, its life seems to be wherever you find liquid water is the rule of thumb on Earth. If you've got water, you've got life. Is that true out in the solar system? Because we know there's liquid water out there in the solar system, particularly under the surface of moons.
Let's take a step back and ask a very broad question. Now, what, in your opinion, are the most important unanswered questions in physics?
In physics, in order of the order that we may discover the answers, dark matter and the related but unrelated dark energy. So the idea is that something like 95.5% of the universe is in a form that we don't understand in terms of the energy in the universe. So matter, that everything's made of that we can see, makes up about between 4.5% and 5% of the energy in the universe. The rest of it's doing something else. We think about 25% of it is in a particle form, which is called dark matter, but it's not the particles that we've discovered at the LHC and elsewhere. So some other new kind of particle. And then about between 60 and 70% is in a form called dark energy, which we know very little about, but it causes the universe to accelerate in its expansion. So there's a lot of energy in the universe taken up with that. The measurement is that we've looked out, particularly at supernova explosions, where you measure the light of them, and you can map out the expansion rate of the universe. And we found about 10, 15 years ago that it's accelerating. Complete mystery, because you would expect it to be slowing down, because you've just got gravity acting between all the galaxies, and it should just be putting a brake on the expansion that was caused by the Big Bang. But it's accelerating, and it's a tremendous mystery. Nobody has a clue what's going on. So that's a deep issue. Whether that'll be dealt with in the next few years, I don't know. But dark matter, good chance we'll find it at the LHC. Good chance we will see it in some deep mine experiments that we've got running at the moment. There have already been hints that maybe some new particles have bumped into those detectors. So it's exciting, that. Very exciting.
One thing that we're doing at Wired later in October is something called Wired Next Generation. It's like an event for 12 to 16-year-olds. And I thought it'd be interesting to ask you what you think is the best way, say, for a parent to get their kids interested in becoming a scientist, and what you think those obstacles are presently.
I think the best way for parents to do that is to just expose their children to these ideas, be it through, you know, books or television or documentary or whatever it is. I think that these ideas are innately interesting. And what you have to do is you have to just make sure they see them. See, it's the idea, actually. In some ways, it's an argument for public service broadcasting, but this gets to off the subject of science. But the point is that it is good to expose people to lots of things so that they can make choices. And the idea that choice, let's say you give your kids choice, they might choose to just play video games all day, or they might choose to just watch football. Well, that doesn't actually provide them with choice, because they have no idea what's out there. So the way to do it, I think, is to show them this landscape of ideas, and let them, they'll pick something. It could be the exploration of the solar system, it could be the LHC, it could be the search for life on Mars, it could be the origin of the universe at the Big Bang. Somewhere, something will ignite a spark. You know, I stumbled across astronomy for some reason when I was little, and I thought, that's great. You know, it's quite easy to stumble across astronomy, actually. You just have to look up, but you'd be surprised how few people do that. So it's one of the challenges we're going to face, actually, how this illusion of choice actually ends up restricting it.
I once actually asked this next question to Brian May from Queen, because a couple of things that I think you and he sort of share in a way. In that, I suppose that you both had a career as a popular musician, and of course
slightly different on levels of success. He was in the biggest rock band in the world, and I wasn't.
Well,
who is that, by the way?
But he now has his PhD in astrophysics. Yeah. And so I wondered, if a younger person asked you which of those two careers, a musician or a scientist, they should pursue, what would you advise them do?
Well, I mean, ultimately, I think science is significantly more rewarding. And in general, it's a much longer-term career, and you'll enjoy using your mind and allowing it to grow much more, that I think, than you will being in an average rock band. There are obviously caveats to this. I mean, Mozart was better doing what he did. You know, I would have been unfortunate if Mozart had turned into a You know, a scientist, and we didn't get all these beautiful music. But I think in general, but you can do both. That's the thing. That I think it's one of the. It's actually, again, not to be political, but it's one of the great problems and tragedies of our education system that it's become seen as some kind of production line where what you do is you prepare yourself. You want to be an engineer because the economy needs engineers. So at GCSE, you'll do these, and at A-level, you'll do this. You go to university, you do this, and you go. That's actually, although it's extremely important that we have that production line going through the economy, on an individual basis, it's unfortunate if you think that that's the way that you should live your life. You should just prepare yourself to do one thing and be economically productive. That's not actually the point of education, it's a side effect. And so you know, in a way, I did both, Brian May did both. People, if they're lucky and fortunate at the moment, can do both. And it would be a better country, actually, a better civilization, if everybody could do both, or three, or four, rather than have this idea that really what education and the acquisition of knowledge is for is to place you into a particular profession so you can go and pay your taxes and contribute to the economy. That's a side effect.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show today. Thank you so much for joining us. What's next for you? Where can people expect to see you next in the world?
Well, I am recording a lecture which is going to be for the Doctor Who 50th anniversary, which is going to be on sometime, I think, around Christmas. Science of Doctor Who. I'm going to explain time travel and how it may be possible, certainly into the future, and I wonder into the past. You have to wait to see the lecture. And then I'm working on so that's going to be fun. And then I'm working on a new big series which is called Human Universe at the moment, and it's a really back to cosmology for me, but it's also an element of science fiction. It's quite exciting mixture. Not science fiction in a sense, but it's there's one about, one of the programs is about how we measured our place in space and time. So how we went from Copernicus to the view of the idea that we know that the universe is 13.798 plus or minus 0.035 billion years old. How did we do that? One of them is about something called the Fermi paradox, which is really about the question. Fermi, Enrico Fermi, great Italian physicist, essentially said if there are civilizations out there, then they would have been here by now. So it's unpicking that. So what did he mean by that? Is it really true that if there was an advanced civilization out there, we'd be able to see it? Probably is, actually. So then the question arises, where are they? What happens? Are civilizations rare? Is complex life rare? Is life rare? So one of that. So it's a wide-ranging series around these kind of issues.
Well, look forward to watching it, and very much enjoy your previous programs. Professor Brian Cox, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Well, thanks again to Brian Cox for joining us on the program. It was one of my favourite interviews of this year, actually, I think. And we wanted to move into a couple of little things before we end the show. The first is we had a whole bunch of entries for our Diablo 3 competition from last week, but I wanted to highlight one in particular. Now, we'd asked for people to come up with what they thought would make a great final boss in a game, somebody from the technology or science or business world. And we've got five winners who will be getting notified by email later this week, so look out for that. But one in particular, this came in from Sanja, and I hope I'm pronouncing their name correctly, who entered with this. I think I have settled on RIM's founder and former CEO, Mike Lazaridis, who resigned earlier this year. He could have a large BlackBerry keyboard, which he could use to hit you with or block your attacks. A special attack could be QWERTY Shower, where it bursts into a fountain of miniature keyboard keys. You could block parts of the attack by trying to compose words. Any keys that you use in a word wouldn't do you damage. And instead of hit points, and this is my favourite bit, when you do damage to him, he would lose share price instead.
Oh, low blow.
Very creative.
I was going to say, we weren't expecting such creative answers, but obviously you have won a copy of Diablo 3, so we'll drop you an email, Sanjay, and thank you very much for such a creative entry. That leaves us to remind you, there's a brand new issue of Wired magazine hitting the shelves right about now. There it goes. Ooh. Which features a special report about the hottest startups in Europe. Not 5, not 10, not 20, but 100 of them from across the continent. So don't miss that. There's also a Sound and Vision mini magazine in there, which includes, if I may say so, a truly fantastic, insightful, and comprehensive guide to audio and visual apps. Because I wrote it. That's also on sale now. Of course, on iPads and tablets, Android and things. So do search for Wired UK in your favourite app store or news agent if you prefer paper things, and give it a read. So that's it. Get in touch. How do they get in touch? Liv?
Twitter, we're at Wired UK. Facebook, facebook.com/WiredUK.
That'll do. See you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
You've finished this week's episode of the Wired.co.uk podcast. Until next week's episode, why not download the latest issue of Wired on your iPad, Android tablet or Kindle Fire? Do so with a discount from wired.co.uk/magazine.
I would like to do a sound check. I sound brilliant.
I imagine I sound average to middling.
You sound
to low.
Good.
How do I sound?
Loud.